Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Before we get going with that, I want to thank the gang of folks who got together with us last night in actually in Elm Grove near Milwaukee at the Elm Grove Women's Club for a listener dinner for Wisconsin Public Radio. Big crowd. We had just some wonderful people. The food was excellent. Kathleen Dunn gave a great talk. She's marvelous, talking about her time interviewing people like John Dean and Studs Terkel and having Bill Clinton and Gloria Steinem on the program at the same time. A really fun time, and thanks to everybody who came. If you ever hear about a listener dinner, appreciation dinner in your area, you ought to sign up. They're really a lot of fun. Really a lot of fun. And it's always a lot of fun to talk with Lisa Johnson. Lisa's with me today, Dane County UW Extension horticulture educator. And she, of course, specializes in horticulture education for you, your home gardener, one sort or another. And, of course, she also works with the horticulture professionals in the green industry. Lisa, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Larry.
Great to have you back. And this time of year, a lot of good things that we have happened through the year. There are a few things that aren't as pleasant as we'd probably like. I see. Seems like there's been a little tar spot around this year. And
yep.
People were asking me about it. Well, what is tar spot? You can explain it for people.
Tar spot is, well, maple tar spot is a fungal disease that is mostly, fortunately, a cosmetic issue,
yeah.
But it does tend to catch people's attention. It forms these large raised black spots on the leaves of usually Norway and silver maple, although other maples are also susceptible. Usually has kind of a little yellow halo around the edge of the lesion. And sometimes, if it's really bad, you can get some leaf drop, but usually it just looks kind of ugly.
Yeah, so we really don't really need to treat it.
No, we don't need to treat it. Oh, and we do have a nice fact sheet about it at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic lab site.
Mm-hmm.
If you just Google PDDC and then UWEX, that should come up for you, and it's under fact sheets. So usually we just recommend breaking up the debris. You can hot compost it, but if you're not hot composting, probably bagging it up and getting rid of it would be better.
Okay, there we go. Already, Dave in Sun Prairie is with us with a question. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for your nice program. A while back, I heard mentioning about having the benefit of having a pond in the garden area.
Yeah.
And so it's something new that I want to try, and I don't really have any information. I haven't really done any research on it or anything, and I just maybe like some basic tips about as far as what size and stuff like that.
What size lawn or what size area do you have to work with, Dave?
My garden is a fenced in 1,000 square feet.
Okay, and you want to put it within that?
Put it right
next to
in
it.
The garden area.
Okay, right in it. Okay.
Right, in one corner or something like that, a central corner area, because it's an L-shaped garden.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So maybe on the cusp of the L, possibly that you'd be putting a little pond in.
Right.
Okay.
Boy, there are so many options.
Oh, I guess so.
Were you looking at having like a waterfall or an open water situation or more of a water feature situation where it wasn't open but it had trickling water or any?
No, nothing like that. Just basically a little pond.
Okay.
And, you know, I have some big stones and stuff I could, you know, border it with and maybe put one in the center or something. And
okay.
I was just questioning how deep maybe to have it. A good idea to maybe line it with plastic, put a little sand in it, you know. And
you definitely want to be There are some really good, almost kits, you could say, that you can
mm-hmm.
aren't there, Lisa, that...
Yeah, there are various options. There are some preformed pond liners that you can get at various home improvement stores that are rigid plastic. You can also buy the pond liner, which is a flexible material. And there are usually instructions with these that, you know, tell you about what you need to put at the bottom underlying it so that you don't get rocks coming up through it. A number of the local businesses do have pond specialty departments, and I would definitely recommend, you know, seeking them out for some advice.
Right.
I don't have any extension publications that are written specifically about ponds. We do have some, you know, on shorelines and so on. But like I say, those businesses would maybe be a good idea because they can tell you what size would fit what kind of air pump, because you do need an air pump and a filter system to keep algae down and make sure you don't have mosquitoes. And
yeah,
it has
you want
to
keep
be
the mosquitoes out. You need some moving water.
Yeah, you need moving water, and it needs to be at least 30 inches deep if you're going to have fish.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't plan on having fish. I'm just interested in maybe it would probably frogs would come in naturally.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You'd be surprised how quickly they'll show up. It's absolutely amazing. I've seen it happen more than once.
Yeah, beneficial garden pets, you know.
Yeah.
Frogs and stuff,
sure,
you know?
Why not? And Kermit. They look great. I'd get one with some moving water. You know, I'd have a little waterfall or something.
Yeah. Right.
I like that.
Because I don't imagine, like, I was thinking, well, maybe just with a put a hose in there once in a while just to move the water, you know, once a week or something like that. Cause,
No, you need to have it more oxygenated and more moving than that. Otherwise, you get just incredible algae buildup. And also, don't sight it under a tree or you're going to have an incredible mess.
There you go. Lots of things to think about. A lot of the garden centers have those setups, and and I've seen them in at our Madison Garden Centers, and certainly around the state you're going to find those. And worth a look, worth talking to those folks. They've done it many times. Thanks again, Dave. Steve in Milwaukee, your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I may be grasping at straws here, but I have a pest problem. We have a postage stamp backyard. And with a maple tree in it. And the birds, the little birds in the neighborhood, have taken a liking to it. And our house, not our house, but our yard is just being inundated with bird droppings. Is there anything that you can recommend that I can do to discourage the birds from sitting in that tree?
Nope.
Something that you mean?
Nothing I can think of offhand.
I'm surprised that, I mean, is this a recent phenomena?
Second year, actually. And, you know, I go out and I hose down the backyard and compost bins and so on and so forth. And they're back at it the next day.
I'm surprised that you're having that much.
I mean,
I can see it at this time of the year.
Yeah.
When we've got migration going, you know, and birds are you know, pulling together to get to head out. Then
I wish these would migrate.
Golly.
They're all year.
Huh. Do you have like a picnic table under there that it's an issue?
Well, we have a table outside, you know, in plants and so on and so forth. But this year it seems like it's really gotten out of hand.
Do you know what kind of birds they are?
Yes, yeah, sparrows, little spotsies, and, you know, little indigenous all year round.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, that is a new one on me.
Yeah, me too. I'm just trying
to. Are there any other trees in your neighborhood?
It just seems odd that they would.
No, I mean, they seem to really like this tree for some reason. Huh. And
it isn't even a fruit.
They just congregate in there. And it's not any particular time of the day that I can identify with. You know, it might be early in the morning, but. Well,
now I'm stumped on that one. I mean, there's short of having a hawk and putting it up in the tree, a live one,
yeah.
because they would soon accustom to a an owl,
yeah, decoy,
stuffed owl or
yeah.
whatever.
I mean, you can try that and try moving it around, but.
Yeah, if you have something like that and you move it around or and change it up, you maybe have two or three different kinds. You move them around, you change it up. Maybe you can get them to start going somewhere else. That's the one thing I can think of.
Yeah.
Short of making a whole bunch of noise and racket to get them to fly away. That's basically – and, you know, once you get them maybe going somewhere else, they'll go on the neighbor's
yeah.
tree or something. But that's a new one for me.
Yeah. Wow.
Good luck. I why not try an owl? And if you can get a hawk, a couple of hawks, plastic hawks or whatever that you could. But you really do need to move them very often.
Yeah.
You can't just let them sit. You can't just let them sit. You can join in, question or comment at 1-800-642-1234. Gardening question, give us a call. At 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. Lisa, you, along with other regular guests like Phil Pelletieri, are part of a special program that airs next week on Wisconsin Public Television, and it's called Wisconsin Gardener, Celebrating Shelley Ryan. And that's actually next week, Thursday. I'm sorry, Thursday at 7 p.m. So that's October 2nd. Mm-hmm. And we have a link up on my Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show. But I'm sure it was kind of bittersweet in some ways to put that together or to work on that.
Yeah. Astrid Neuenhaus and I went to Allen Centennial for our part of it. To be interviewed, and certainly there were a few times we had to stop filming in order to clear our eyes and,
yeah.
you know. Shelley was such a bright, laughing spirit.
Oh, wasn't she fun? Do you have a favorite memory or one? Yeah, there's so many.
Oh, gosh, yeah, it's really hard to pick. I guess one thing that I remember in particular, she had this very impish sense of humor.
And an impish look, too.
Yes, she did. And she liked to rib people. And she got as good as she gave. It was really hard to get through an episode without, you know, an attack of giggles because she was just so funny. But there was... one time I led a master gardener crew to her house to do some cleanup. This is when she had cancer and she wasn't able to get
yeah.
into her yard to do as much gardening as she wanted to. And I had been to her house twice to do filming. But somehow or other, I, with my famous lack of direction, got lost. And the master gardeners arrived at least half an hour before me. And so when I got there, ever after that, she'd say, "Now, are you sure you know how to get here?" She never let me forget that.
Oh, man. Well, you know, she'd laugh at herself, too. She and I did shows together at the Garden Expo,
uh-huh.
and we do up in front of people and talk and whatnot. But she'd always have a whole bunch of outtakes.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she of her goofing up. And
yes. I think we've all done that.
she'd laugh at herself
yes.
just as well as she.
Oh yeah.
Anyway,
so
that's
going
to be a very good show, and probably a hard. I'm sure there'll be a tear or two shed for that one. That's next week on Wisconsin Public Television, 7 p.m. on Thursday. That's October 2nd. And we have a link up on my Facebook page, so I hope you'll go and take a
yeah.
look at that if you're...
And I believe it's being replayed?
Yeah, it will.
Yeah.
I'm not sure when.
I think on the Saturday the 4th, but I'm... Don't quote me
it's
on
probably
that.
Up, well, I'm
it's
sure
probably
it's on my
the website.
It's on my Facebook
yeah.
page for sure. So there you go. That's next week. Annie in Dalton is online with us, and she has a question, so let's go to her. Hi, Annie.
Hello. My hostas did not like last winter very well at all. And I've got them scattered throughout the yard, and I'm very proud of them, but they came back smaller. So I'm assuming there was some winter kill?
It's possible. Hostas are very, very winter hardy. They're hardy to like zone three, which is up in the middle of the state. When I've had problems with hostas coming back smaller, it's often been because we had a dry fall and I didn't water them enough, and so they had some issues. Or I've had a perennial problem underneath my silver maple, which is such a water pig that it really stresses them.
That explains the white pine ones. They don't do as well as the white pine.
Yeah, okay. Root competition can be a problem with hostas.
So you need more water.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I need to even though we've had a really good late summer rain, I need to make sure they get long drinks still.
Yeah. If we don't get rain for the week and, you know, we haven't gotten an inch of water, I would make sure that they do get that.
And Annie, you, and for everybody else, keep that hose out until we get ground freezing.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, when we have a dry fall.
Is there a fertilizing I should be doing to them, or trying to cover them, or does that not matter?
We're just initial water.
No, I wouldn't fertilize now. Although you can certainly fertilize in the spring. If you don't use a mulch currently, a mulch is not a bad idea.
Yeah.
It unfortunately does give the slugs and earwigs a little bit more place to hide in. But it is really good, particularly like under your pines, as you were mentioning, if you're trying to keep moisture in. So no more than about inch and a half to 2 inches, though.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Annie. Thanks for calling. Lisa Johnson, Dane County Extension Horticulture Educator, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking gardening and lawns and trees and everything else with Lisa Johnson, our Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. You can join. I think we have one open line at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. And if you've got a great photo, we'd love to see that too. We've got a good garden photo or flower photo. Sarah in Reedsburg. It is your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I have some tulip and daffodil bulbs that I bought about 3 years ago, and I just never got them in the ground, and they've been sitting in my basement in a bag. Is there any chance those would grow if I planted them this fall, or a way to test them to see if they would grow?
Have you squeezed them at all or pinched them?
I have not squeezed them.
I bet you're going to get as...
I bet they're going to go crunch. Usually, something stored that long is not going to be viable. It probably has dried out. So if they're still firm, I mean, there's a small chance, but
they're still firm. I'd throw them in the ground.
Yeah,
but I can't believe.
But I can't imagine they will be.
They will have shrunk.
Yep, shriveled up.
All right. I'll feel them out.
Feel them out, Sarah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, man. Mike on Facebook wondered about Creeping Charlie, slowly but surely taking over the backyard. Covers about 40% of the small west side of the yard. We have two kids. I'm trying to find a safe, though time-efficient, option. Well, there really isn't any.
unfortunately, Creeping Charlie being a perennial and having the root structure that it does, it's a really difficult weed to get rid of. There are a couple of chemical controls that you may or may not be willing to try with your kids. But they are best applied if you're going to go that route. There are two different times of year. One is in May, just after their
blooming
time, their peak bloom. And the other is right around second week in October when we've had our first frost. You only want to apply the herbicides when they're going to be of the most use with this particular plant and any plant. But usually what they recommend is products with 2,4-D in them. You can use products with dicamba, but those can cause problems with your trees. If you have trees in the area, I'd only use that once a year. But the timing, again, is very important. And we have a great fact sheet on Creeping Charlie that is at the PDDC site. So if you Google the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, there's a great fact sheet on that. Unfortunately, just pulling doesn't typically do it. Mulching doesn't typically do it. So I really don't have a silver bullet for you, unfortunately.
Yeah, the best thing in talking with some of our lawn people has been to try and keep a healthy lawn.
Right.
You know, if you keep a healthy lawn and your Kentucky bluegrass, typically if it's not shaded, you've probably got Kentucky bluegrass, and it'll outcompete it. So I have in the past gotten on my hands and knees with daughter Emily and pulled it.
Yeah, and then reseed.
And then you do a little reseeding and fertilizing and making sure get some nitrogen down on the lawn, get it going. Mm-hmm. It'll outcompete it.
Right, as long as it's not in shade where the bluegrass has some troubles. But yeah, and you might have to excavate some areas of your yard and, put in new soil and do seeding. You could do that still this time of year, although usually the second week of October is the cutoff. But since that's also a time when Creeping Charlie is more vulnerable, you may want to try doing it then.
I will have to admit, and did mention this on a previous show at one point, several weeks back, I think, I was so mad at a previous house over the Creeping Charlie, I eliminated my lawn.
Oh, with the borax?
Started all over again, and it wasn't a year, and the Creeping Charlie was
right back.
The neighbors on both sides just at that point, I'm just going to try and keep a healthy lawn and, I'll beat it back once in a while by the hand picking. And actually, I was surprised at how much you could pick in a lawn in 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Two people out there picking. We had big piles of it.
That's it. You can get your kids to see who can pull the longest continuous thread
of it. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, and don't use the borax. You may come across that online, but it unfortunately doesn't work with Wisconsin soils, and Larry found that out himself.
I did that, and it did not work.
No.
It didn't work. Marilyn in Black River Falls, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning. I have a question about my pine trees, and the needles have turned brown on the ends, and then it kind of goes inward, and now I have a couple that died on me.
Okay.
They're about 15 years old, and they're white pines.
Okay.
It's spreading from one to the neck.
Oh. Are there needles looking? How do they look?
Just brown and rust-colored brown. Well, just totally
white
brown.
White pine blister rust?
It could be white pine blister rust. Do you have any cankers in the tree? Are you seeing white sap or resin on the bark?
Nope, nothing like that.
Okay. There are a number of different fungal problems. One is rhizosphera. There are some other types as well. White pine blister rust would have been my first guess, especially if it's spreading and has killed your tree. But I guess what I would do is get some samples into Brian at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. And have him grow out a pathogen in the lab so he can identify it for you. Because there are just, there are so many that can cause brown needles, but you need to know exactly what it is in order to treat it properly.
Treatments differ quite a bit, frankly.
Okay, now it seems to be spreading to my real old ponderosa pines, too. Is that possible, different varieties?
Well, it depends on what you've got.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some things that will spread, but...
Yeah.
Okay, so you said that was plant disease, fungal?
Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. If you look it up online, you can just Google PDDC. Do you have internet access?
Yes, I do.
Okay, yeah. So
PDDC, so as for Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic.
And then if you also put in UWEX, it should come right up, and it has the phone number, so you can talk to Brian or whoever's at the clinic, and they can tell you how to package the sample and send it and so on. Oh, and I want to make an announcement that Brian is the winner of the 2014 Academic Staff Award of Excellence.
Yeah, that's wonderful. He's a good guy.
He's a good guy.
Dr. Death. So there you go, Marilyn. Give him a call. Go online and get the number. We probably have a link even on my Facebook page, but PDDC UWEX, and it's going to come. You're going to get it online. Mabel in Duluth. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, I heard the gentleman call in about the birds. And I saw this on one of our clinics in town. They seem to have a lot of problem with seagulls nesting, and, of course, then they get a lot of defecation all over the buildings. And one of the buildings, they have got three imitation hawks, and they're tethered down to the roof of the building, and you see these things swooping around with the air currents.
Oh!
And I thought, these things look so real. You just have to watch them for a while to know that they don't fly away. But I don't know if you could find them on the internet. I've thought about getting them for here for my garden, but I have a lot of power lines. But I would think all birds will respect hawks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And, oh, that's a good. Well, so they hang them sort of like a mobile.
Yeah, but they're tethered down to the roof. So then they have a wire that goes up, and the birds just take the air current and swoop around.
Huh.
And it's so real, I can't believe it.
Oh, my goodness.
What will they think of next?
That is a great idea.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that call. Well, you, I suppose.
Learned something today.
Learn something new every day. And I bet if you go online and just sort of type in that explanation, it's going to pop up.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to pop up.
Imitation hawk for
that
bird.
That flies.
Yeah, something like that. Bird control.
We have. Janice next in Marshfield. And so
hello.
Hi, Janice. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I don't know if you guys can help me, but this year I had beautiful squash and pumpkins in my garden, and they had grown 6 feet up. The trellis looked great, and then they all died. And as I looked around, it seemed like there was a squash vine borer.
Yes.
That was the explanation. And I was just wondering if you had any suggestions on how to avoid this next year.
Okay, sure. First of all, we do have a fact sheet. I know I'm beginning to sound like a broken record here. But there is a fact sheet at the PDD site.
Mm-hmm.
And
PDDC site.
Yes, PDDC site. That will give you more information. But what I can tell you is, first of all, rip out any of the squash that were affected and make sure that you get the borers out of there.
Get rid of the vines.
Yeah, get rid of the vine in case there's anybody still hanging out in there.
So it's the vines, it's not necessarily the roots.
They will invade the bottom, like, 12 inches of the stem. What happens is that the adult will lay its eggs on the stem, and then the borer will bore into the stem and root around in the vascular system and disrupt the water transport tissue so that the vine wilts. Now, what you can do if it's early enough in the season, before your vine has died, is if you see the hole with some frass, which is the insect poop, basically.
Okay.
You can take a sharp knife and go into the stem, remove the borer, and then pile up soil on top of that area of the stem. Another thing that some people will do if they've had problems with this typically is early in the season as the vine is developing, usually in, May, end of May or so, because usually you don't put these things out too early, is you take some aluminum foil and wrap it around the base of the stem so that the insect can't lay its eggs there. That's another way to
Like that bottom foot and a half or so.
Yeah, that bottom foot and a half. Looks kind of goofy, but it's effective.
Yeah, and it's cheap.
So if I'm putting out seedlings that are like Memorial Day weekend or something, so just keep wrapping that.
Yeah, you know, usually they don't start until I should look at my fact sheet here to find out. I seem to remember it's like mid to end of June when they're laying their eggs.
Oh.
So, you know, it has to be of a decent diameter for them to actually start laying. And I don't remember off the top of my head when that is, but usually when they're about half an inch in diameter to an inch in diameter.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
sure.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And what an inexpensive and chemical-free, essentially, way to deal with that.
Okay,
problem.
Here we go. I finally found it here. They overwinter as pupa in the soil. So, you know, getting the material out, but you may still have some in the soil. Okay, they're going to be laying their eggs when the chicory is blooming. So about the same time as the Japanese beetles appear.
Appear, yeah.
You can look on the stems and you can actually sometimes see the brown eggs on the base of the plants. And so that's usually going to actually be late June, July that they're going to be laying the eggs.
Yeah, there we go. We had, you mentioned earlier and a procedure, and I've lost it. I had it up on my screen a minute ago. Hot composting. That was the comment. And someone on Facebook said, hey, what's the hot composting?
Hot composting is a procedure where you're composting what we might call properly. I'm a lazy composter myself, and I layer my greens and my browns, the greens being the fresh material, and then you put browns, which are dead leaves or soil or cardboard or something on top of it. But when you're hot composting, you're bringing that soil or that compost pile up to about 130 degrees or so, because that will kill most pathogens and weed seeds and so on. If you don't turn your compost pile and water your compost pile and have it layered properly and so on, then it doesn't reach that. You can buy a compost thermometer. It's this big, long thing, about 18 inches long, and you stab it into the middle of the pile, and it'll tell you when it reaches the appropriate temperature. But if you're like me and you do throw things in your compost pile and they do eventually rot, but I end up, if I want to use that compost in the garden, I have to expect a lot of weed seeds and pathogens. So
yeah, same way.
Yeah, your battles, Larry.
Yeah, that's right. You want to spend a lot of time on that, I know exactly what you're talking about. Karen in Whitewater, hello. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. We had a rather disastrous garden year this year. Between what we think were chipmunks and grasshoppers, we lost all our coleus, all our impatiens, almost all our bulbs. The garden is completely full of little holes and chewed leaves.
Oh, my goodness.
That sounds awful.
So I'm trying to avoid it next year.
Okay. Well, let me ask about the impatiens in particular. Did they just sort of dissolve, or did they have holes?
All their leaves are gone. There's just stems left.
Okay. That could be downy mildew. We've been having some major problems with downy mildew.
Yeah.
And usually it just causes the plant to kind of dissolve, but often it will cause defoliation. So that you may not be able to blame that one on the chipmunks.
Well, grasshoppers, too, because all our coleus is eaten up.
Okay. Whitewater. Okay. Grasshoppers, I'm not aware that in most parts of the area they haven't
been that bad.
Yeah.
I can't imagine. It's completely denuding.
You'd
have seen them in operation.
Did you see a lot of grasshoppers?
We did. We're right on Lake Whitewater, and there were quite a few hopping and flying around, and I didn't think anything of it until I realized all my coleus had huge holes in it. And I also blamed the impatience on the grasshoppers, but also the holes in the garden. So it was terrible.
Did you have, is it sun coleus or shade coleus?
The shade coleus.
Okay.
There were a few that survived, the very bright leaves, but all the ones with the pretty little ruffled leaves are all gone.
Okay. Have you had problems with slugs or earwigs?
Not that I noticed.
Okay. The reason that I ask is that grasshoppers are more likely to attack things in the sun than they are in the shade. And since slugs and earwigs come out at night,
yeah,
you may not
night operators.
See them. But it wouldn't be uncommon for them to totally denude hostas.
Really?
And yeah, they can chew big holes in hostas, coleus, impatiens. So
that's what we have. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you may want to put.
What do I do for next spring?
What you might want to do in those shady areas is put down a slug bait. You can use, there's a product called Escargot and Slug-O that are, I know, it's funny, iron phosphate tablets. There are also other products that you can use that are more toxic, so I recommend the others first. You may also want to use the typical beer in a pan thing,
yeah.
Just to see
yeah.
how many you get, because because of our very wet year this year, we had a banner year for slugs and
yep.
earwigs. So I know my hostas and other things in the shade suffered a lot more than usual. Now, with the chipmunks, we do have a nice publication at the Learning Store. And if you just Google Learning Store, UWEX, and go to the Natural Resources section, they have a number of techniques you can use for chipmunks because they can be very destructive.
Mm-hmm. But they don't eat the leaves the way.
No, they dig tunnels. Dig plants up.
But they're not going to sit there and munch on the leaves.
No,
the way
not usually.
That's more slug and earwig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, they do things like occasionally they'll bite the heads off of tulips. All the rabbits do that, too. That's just so rude, you know, and then they don't even eat them. You know, if they ate them, that might be one thing. But that's what I would do for the grasshoppers. Boy, they're really difficult to control.
Well, there's not much you can do. There's, one year they're going to be bad, and then you might not have any or very few for several years, and then here they come again. So I guess I wouldn't try to control them because they blow in from, I mean, you could treat the ones that are there, but there's just going to be some more that come blowing in,
mm-hmm.
blowing in. Yeah. Thanks for calling, Karen. Yep, pardon?
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Yeah, appreciate your call. Lisa Johnson, our guest, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller visiting with Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. Questions? Give us a call. We have a couple of open lines at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Corey in Oshkosh, thanks a lot for waiting. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just caught the end of the previous conversation regarding Creeping Charlie.
Yeah.
And I have a situation in Oshkosh where we have Creeping Charlie, and it's in shade to sun area, and I know you said Kentucky bluegrass will compete with Creeping Charlie in sun, but what about when you get into more of a shady area or partial shade?
Yeah, it's harder.
Is there another type of grass or just pretty much stick with Kentucky bluegrass?
No.
Fescues.
Yes, the fescues, and we do have a publication at the Learning Store that's called Growing Grass in Shade. And it recommends for either dry shade or moist shade some different species that you can grow. Depending on how much sun or how much shade, you need to adjust for more or less fescue. And if it's like morning sun or afternoon sun, there may be a difference there.
Yeah.
But Yeah, the fescues are the ones that are particularly better for shade.
And it is tougher to get them thicker.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It just really is harder. And so they'll compete, but not nearly as well as Kentucky bluegrass will in the sun.
Are you able to grow grass well in that area to begin with?
Actually, don't really have a problem with it. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, good.
Yeah.
Curious about anything that would compete with the Creeping Charlie, you know, once we make attempts to get rid of it. So.
Yeah.
You might get that publication because you could be overseeding or start reseeding some of the new grasses that are recommended.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's at the Learning Store. And what's the website to reach that?
It's learningstore.uwex.edu.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah. And it's called Growing Grass in Shade. And when you go to the lawn and garden section, there's a whole section on turf.
Yep. There you go.
Excellent. All right, thank you for your time.
Yep, thanks, Corey. Appreciate the call. And we have Bruce in Milwaukee next. Hi, Bruce. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I was just curious. There's a woodworking shop over by me that has, like, sawdust and stuff like that, but it's black walnut.
Ooh.
Would that be all right for mulching?
No.
No.
Unfortunately, that is still going to have not as much of the juglone as the roots have, but I definitely would not use it as a garden mulch. That could be an issue.
Yep.
Well, like regular pine would be fine. It's just
pine would be okay. But do keep in mind that heavy carbon sources like that have not been composted may tie up nitrogen in your garden as the microbes break it down. And so you may need to add some more nitrogen fertilizer to prevent having a nitrogen deficiency problem.
Yeah.
What works for making good nitrogen for a garden?
Well, if you're using a traditional product, any of the soluble, water-soluble products like Miracle-Gro would be fine. If you wanted to use an organic product, cow manure is going to be a lot less high in nitrogen, and it's going to give you some other things, but it's going
chicken
to be
manure.
Really good for your soil. Yes, chicken manure is one of the ones that's higher in nitrogen. Urea products.
Horse manure
is a little bit lower in nitrogen. And again, all of these products should be composted. You don't want to put fresh manure on your garden. But chicken manure is probably the highest in nitrogen. You can also get urea, which can be derived from organic sources. Blood meal for very small areas you could mix in.
Yeah. So lots of options there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you're going to need to do it because...
fresh sawdust is really
that
pretty.
Really ties up the nitrogen.
Yeah.
Eventually, it gets loose, but
but in the meantime, your plants may suffer.
And let's go to Janet in Marshfield next. Hi, Janet. Thanks for calling.
Hi, this is Janet. I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
One, I had a master gardener's place, bought some. Plants that were marked as delphiniums, and I didn't know what a delphinium looked like, and I guess they still don't because they grew up as like 9-foot black-eyed Susan, black-eyed Susans, and that's not a delphinium. I know that, but
mm-hmm.
I want to know how to move them, because one of them is right in front of the patio window.
Okay. That sounds like one of the native prairie species of black-eyed Susan.
Okay.
Those could be moved in the spring. You just get your shovel out and dig them up to about 6 or 8 inches deep, making sure you have a good root ball around the roots, and they should be pretty easy to move.
Okay, but wait till spring.
Yeah, I would probably wait till spring at this point.
Yep.
Okay. Another question I had was about putting mulch over the top of wood chips, because the wood chips are only about maybe an inch deep at some places. And I have, you know, the new plants anyway. Would I do that, or did I would I just not mulch over the top of the wood chips?
Okay. Typically, I think of wood chips as being mulch, so I'm not sure what kind of mulch are you talking about.
We're thinking about straw.
Oh, straw. Okay. Is this in a perennial garden?
Yes.
Okay. You shouldn't need to put anything more other than the wood chips that are on there already. Now, if you've got new plantings that have just gone in that are in small pots, that if you were worried about heaving over the winter, maybe you could put some straw down, but you'd probably need to remove it again next year. So I probably would just use more wood chips since that's what you've already got.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. If you were going to do something, this is the covering things and that, you wait till after their ground's frozen, do you not, Lisa?
Yeah, if you haven't already got mulch down, particularly like in perennial gardens, then putting it down after the ground has frozen, that's usually what's called winter mulch that is put in place to keep the ground frozen. If you've already got mulch there and you just wanted to top dress it, you can do it at any time now. But if you were, you know, trying to use it for protecting things over winter, yes, then do wait until the ground freezes.
Jeff in Nina, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, hello. I'm going in for some knee surgery in about a week after I replace a knee, and I want to get some gardening done before I do. Is it too early to cut back the peonies?
Oh, yeah. You should wait until the first frost so that you don't stimulate them to try and grow new leaves yet this season. Probably by the second week in October when we have a killing frost, then it's time to cut back the peonies. But you want to wait until they turn brown.
And that's the same with almost any perennials.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, you're kind of out of luck on that, Jeff.
Looks like I'll be hiring somebody to do it.
I'm sorry, but
thank you very much.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with your surgery, too.
Yep.
Appreciate the call. And Rich in Middleton, hi. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call.
Yeah, thank you for the call. It's a great show, and reminded of the false praise that's offered on Tuesday mornings on one of the other shows. So, appreciate this. So we've got planted a couple of trees over the last couple of years that were damaged by the cold winter. About two, three years ago, we planted a 6 to 7 foot multi-stem Japanese maple.
Mm-hmm.
And after last winter, we lost about 2/3 of the leaves.
Oh.
Now the tree is starting to come back. I haven't seen any come on those stems that have been lost, so I know it's not dead. So, you know, what's the chance of those other stems coming back, and anything we can do to help them recover? We've kept it well watered this year,
and then
when should we wait to cut off any of the dead stems or do any pruning to that tree?
Dead stems should be removed
right
promptly.
Away.
Since we're sure at this point that they're not going to come back, I mean, I was advising people this spring to wait a while because some things took quite some time, like into the middle of June, to really get leafed out. But at this point, the ones that appear dead should be taken out.
But check to make sure that they are dead and scratch the bark a little
bit.
Yeah,
you can do that, but I'm sure if they haven't leafed out by now, they're toast.
Goners.
Well, yeah, I thought that too, but in addition, though, we planted some bare root plants from Arbor Day Foundation last fall, and then we got some this spring. Several of them died off or appeared to have died off,
mm-hmm.
and the main stems didn't come, and then in the last month to 2 months, some of them have started shooting up little leaders from the root.
Okay, yeah, those are suckers. Now, on some plants that are grafted, you don't want the suckers because they're mm-hmm. going to be a different kind of plant. Mm-hmm. If this was something like a dogwood shrub or
there's dog.
Yeah, dogwood shrubs.
Dogwood, crabapple, even a tulip tree I noticed is now shooting up some growth.
Okay.
I mean,
not what you expected.
Yeah.
No, that's what I'm wondering about the Japanese maple.
Yeah, the Japanese maple.
Until next year.
The Japanese maple is likely to be grafted. So if you do see shoots coming up from, you know, the root system, I would take those out because they're not likely to be the same variety. With the dogwood, which is a suckering shrub, probably no problem. I would say that you are getting some from the root system, but that's not an issue with that type of plant. The tulip tree, I don't know whether those are grafted or not. Obviously, the root system wasn't entirely dead. So,
yeah, some of these are only a foot big.
Yeah, right. But sometimes they only have enough energy to push out a little bit of growth, and it may make it over the winter, it may not. I would just take out the dead material and then see what comes back next year.
What would the downside be of waiting till spring to trim back the Japanese maple?
Not a problem.
No.
It's been on there this long, so
it's not gonna hurt.
Yeah. Okay. As long as there wasn't any disease involved that's being transmitted to the tree, if it was just winter kill, it's not a big problem.
No. And Rich, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lisa Johnson, our guest today, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator, comes by pretty often to talk with us here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gardening can be such a pleasure, can it? And depending on where we are in the season, there are lots of things to take care of. Late in the growing season like we are now, I'm betting you have plenty of tasks to do around your garden, probably not enough hours in the day to get them done. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Net as we visit with Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator Lisa Johnson, who comes by ever so often, and great to have her. And, you know, all the Extension Horticulture Educators do such a wonderful job. Whenever we have them on, I never really worry about limiting the conversation to a specific plant or something like that, because people like Lisa can talk about a whole variety of things. And it's always great to have you along. Thank you, Lisa, for coming.
Well, thank you.
We have Bill in Fitchburg with a question, so let's go to Bill. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is about the impatiens and the downy mildew, is that what you called it?
Yes.
And what can be done in the future so we don't have that problem?
Well, unfortunately, the answer is to not grow impatiens. The spores will stay in the soil for quite some time. Now, you can grow New Guinea impatiens. Those are not susceptible. There are other annuals that you can grow in the shade, begonias, Berwalia, to name a couple, shade coleus. But unfortunately, the impatiens, I think you're going to find a lot less of them in the marketplace because this is becoming such a widespread issue. We do have a fact sheet at PDDC, the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic website, that you can take a look at. There are some fungicides that you can use prophylactically if you really want to try and grow impatiens there, but it's probably best not to try and fight Mother Nature. The problem with it is that you can get a plant that is infected with it already and it's not showing symptoms.
That's the problem.
So that's why the greenhouses are making a real effort not to propagate anything that is infected, and they're also just cutting down on the amount that they sell because it is becoming such an issue.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Bill.
Sorry for the bad news.
Yeah, really. Larry in Oshkosh, what's on your mind?
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I had a couple sweet cherry trees. Stella was the variety.
Mm-hmm.
I lost the entire top out of one of them a few years ago, but it came back well. Now I've lost, I maybe have four uprights coming out of that, and I've lost two of those. Is it, it leafed out, but then the leaves just dropped. What's the likelihood it'll recover if I were to trim that out?
I would say it doesn't sound very very promising. Stella is a Zone 5 plant, and I'm thinking about Oshkosh and where it's located. It's probably pretty marginally hardy there. If you have a protected area that you want to try and grow a new one in, you might try that. But you can certainly go ahead and take out the material that was damaged and see. But if you have material coming back from the roots, since it's a grafted variety, it's going to be different. And if you're having continual problems with dieback, there may be a disease issue going on there as well.
Two or three of the uprights there are healthy with leaves on them.
Okay.
Leafed out all summer.
Mm-hmm.
I have had the tree for about 25 years.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Amazing.
That is amazing.
Wow. I'm impressed.
25.
Yeah,
wow.
That is great. Like I said, take out the dead branches. I really am not sure whether the dieback is caused by our extra cold winter or whether there may be some disease issue going on in there. But I guess if it's a tree that's hung on that long, I would give it the benefit of the doubt.
I would too, sure. 25 years is just amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You did something right, Larry.
Next 25.
Yeah.
There you go.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, boy. What do you suggest, Joe from Winona Wonders, to help plants survive rabbits in the winter? Last year, they devoured the yucca and the burning bush for Joe.
Yeah, burning bush are really very popular with rabbits voles in winter. And particularly, when we have a heavy snow cover, about the only thing that you can do, well, there are a couple different things, but the best thing to do is to get some quarter-inch hardware cloth mesh from your local hardware store and just fence in your plant for the winter. I usually use some sod staples, which are kind of hairpin-shaped pieces mm-hmm. that you use to make sure that the hardware cloth is nailed into the ground so that the voles and rabbits can't get under it. And I try and get it at least 3 feet tall so that if we have a foot and a half of snow, that at least we discourage the rabbits. The other thing that you can do, although you have to replenish it a few times, is you may want to use a repellent spray like Ropel or liquid fence, but that wears off after a while, and particularly once the material is frozen, it isn't as good. But that's one thing you can do. I've actually had rabbit damage in the past few weeks, which really surprised me because I don't usually see them at this time of year gnawing on my shrubs, but boy, they've been gnawing on some of my shrubs. That ticks me off because I'm like, yeah, you're not supposed to be here now.
Oh, man. I bought a couple of pumpkins.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's cool. I'm going to get a couple of pumpkins and put them out on the step, on the front stoop. And it wasn't rabbits, but those doggone squirrels.
Oh, squirrels, yeah.
Came and started gnawing away on them.
Ah, it's like carving is one thing, but squirrel art is definitely something else.
Oh, made me a little angry. And Tom in Madison has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hearing how wide-ranging the topics have been today, I thought I'd ask a tree question.
Sure.
I have a 45-plus-year-old black walnut that has growing very, very close to its trunk base. A locust, the kind that get the curly beans on them.
Okay, black locust, which is considered an invasive species.
It's it's invading my yard. It's popping mm-hmm. up all over the place.
It yeah. suckers. Yep.
Yes.
So I would.
You want to get rid of it?
Yeah, I would take.
Well, I'm wondering, will that harm? I'm kind of liking its placement there because it kind of blocks off the vision of. It's kind of nice, but is it harming my black walnut?
Well, it's going to get to be a big tree.
Will it?
Yeah, eventually. You know, you're talking 15, 20 inches in diameter. So probably it would be best to remove it before it becomes such an issue. And I would cut it down, and at the base I would paint it with Roundup. Use at least 20% active ingredient Roundup, and you just take a paintbrush and paint that right on. It should stay in the root system of the black walnut, or not the black walnut, the black locust, so it shouldn't harm your walnut, but I would definitely get rid of it, because otherwise it'll keep popping up in your yard, too, in different spots.
All over the place. And you need to do that, make that application, if you're going to do that, right after you cut the tree.
Right. And this is a great time of year to do it because the trees are starting to pull down the photosynthates from their leaves. And so it's a good time for chemical uptake.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Good luck. Appreciate the call. We have... something from Cheryl in Berlin. I've been growing roses for many years, and now at the end of summer, one of my bushes has something growing underneath it. Light green pods about the size of peas. When I crack them open, they have white worms inside. Hmm. What are they, and what can we do about it? I don't know.
Good question. I'm wondering if it is some kind of borer that is in the rose stems, or
you know what you should do on that one? I'd be tempted.
Send us a picture.
I would, send us a picture, or even send one to the insect diagnostic lab. You mm-hmm. think it might go there? And who's our new guy?
PJ Leash.
PJ Leash would if you go to the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab and send a picture, mm-hmm. you probably get a pretty quick answer.
Yeah, PJ's great. Yeah, he's very responsive.
Very responsive.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like, I mean, to me it sounds like a stem gall-forming insect of some kind, but I don't know whether it's a major problem for your roses or not from the description and without seeing it.
Renee and Eau Claire, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Well, I heard that lady with the grasshopper problem, and I've got the same thing, and I had it last year. Just horrible. They even eat the rhubarb leaves. But just as, like, my gladiolas, dahlias, cannas, about the only thing they don't like, they don't care for the zinnias too much, just as the buds are ready to open, this, get them all. I mean, I'm to the point where I don't even want to plant them anymore, and I noticed they are mating. So I know you said there's not much to do about it, but couldn't a person on a cold night when they can't move, aren't they going to be laying their eggs in the same place? That's kind of my question.
Boy, grasshoppers are definitely not my specialty.
You know, you might wanna,
PJ would probably
PJ.
Be.
Yeah, you know, you might want to run that one by him at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. And, I just had Phil on the show, and we didn't get a single question about grasshoppers, I don't think.
Yeah, now we got two. So I'm kind of wondering what's
and
going
I
on
asked
with that.
Other people, and they don't seem to have them. I'm on a farm here.
Yeah. Well,
I'm wondering if they were on some crops nearby that were harvested.
We don't have a hay, but there's been no hay brought into the yard or anything. It's no.
I know they are cyclical in their population, and you might be inundated with them for a couple of years. But are you on sandy soil or are you?
Yep.
Because the previous person was also, I think, in a sandy soil area. I would check with PJ about that, whether there's something you can do with that.
A quick note to him, the Insect Diagnostic Lab, UW-Madison, you can send a question and you'll get a pretty quick response. You definitely will. And I'm just surprised it didn't come up last week when we were talking with Phil, if there was such an issue about it.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. And, you know, there are different species and different life cycles. So it probably would be helpful for him to know, too, you know, what they look like, whether they're the small 1-inch size or whether they're the larger size or a mix of the different species.
Good luck. Thanks, Renee. Bill in Ashland, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hey. Hey, you know, you guys mentioned hot compost before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was kind of wondering, this has been in the back of my mind for years now, I was wondering, could you use hot compost to heat a greenhouse without the gas blowing up or poisoning you or something like that?
I know they do use Will Allen at Growing Power in Milwaukee. They do use worm compost to partly help heat their greenhouse. I don't know exactly how they do it, whether they've got it in bins or what the story is there. But I know that they do use worm compost. Now, I'm not sure about vegetable compost. I mean, there would be some methane that would be released, and it might be kind of stinky. But
it'd be stinky.
Yeah. But I know that that is something that is used. What I'm trying to think, I don't think we have a publication on that as of yet. But you might want to check with Schweck. S-H-W-E-C. If you Google that on the internet, that is the solid waste and recycling and composting part of Extension. And Joe Van Rossum is the compost guru who teaches master composting across the state. And he might have some resources for you about that.
Yep. Be oh, worth certainly
sounds,
worth a look.
Yeah. So
that's pretty cool.
S-H-W-E-C Schweck. Schweck.
There it is.
Blah.
What an acronym. Thanks, Bill, and good luck. Joe does a good job.
Yeah.
Mike in Whitewater, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I have a question about high bush cranberries. I have two of them that are older bushes. I noticed that they do seem to new growth seems to come up from the root system.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering if I can cut back the older part of the bushes.
Yes, you can. This is a type of viburnum. High bush cranberry is actually a type of viburnum. It's unfortunately very susceptible to viburnum borer. So if you see some of your larger, older branches dying back, check at the base to see if there are holes and kind of sawdusty looking frass. It's actually recommended that you do keep them pruned so that the new growth is more dominant, because that seems to be a little bit more resistant to the viburnum borer. So the best time to do that would be either during the dormant season or in the spring. And what you should do is cut out the biggest, oldest canes, about a third of them, right down to the base, and then you can do shaping on the rest of it. You can cut them back pretty severely. I wouldn't go more than half. But again, it should be either done in the dormant season or early spring.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Thank you, Mike, for calling. And Larry in Chautauqua. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon or good morning. I had, it's probably relatively a question of the rhubarb that we have growing.
Mm-hmm.
Do I cut it back? Do I let it grow? I mean, do I let it go and let it?
Yeah.
What do I do with the rhubarb still there?
Yeah, sure. You should wait until the killing frost, and then you can cut it back.
But wait
cut
until
it all,
wait till it dies.
Yeah, cut it to the base after it dies back.
Cut it right to the ground then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a perennial, so it will
come back.
Oh, okay. Because it still looks pretty good yet.
You wouldn't want to.
Yeah.
I don't know that you'd want to eat it anymore.
No.
Don't eat it?
Not at this time of year. If it has been subjected to frost, it can get the oxalic acid from the leaves gets caught in the petioles, which are the part that you eat, and that can cause you some, I mean, that's possible hospitalization you're looking at there.
Yeah,
so
you don't want to fool.
You don't want to mess with that.
Okay.
Yeah, usually we only harvest it for a while in the spring. It typically gets pretty hard and not very tasty.
It gets fibrous.
Yeah, very fibrous and not so much fun to eat. But once we start to get cool weather and frost, I definitely would not eat that.
Cheryl wondered if it's too late to plant perennials.
No, you can still plant perennials up really until the ground freezes. Now, there are, if you're talking about marginal ones, you know, that are marginally hardy, I might wait, but certainly hostas. I've got some hostas in my garage waiting for me to plant them. Daylilies, you can still be dividing perennials, and this is the time of year to divide peonies. Yeah, go for it.
Colleen on Facebook bought some beautiful mums last week, but wants to keep them through the winter to plant in the spring. And if she does that, and how? And I'm not sure you'd have anything left to.
Yeah, that if you were planning on keeping them like inside as a house plant, that's going to be iffy.
Yeah.
And if you were going to plant them, they should be planted as soon as possible because it takes them a while to get established. And we typically have more winter kill on ones that are planted later in the season as opposed to earlier. So if you did want to keep them inside as a house plant, you can try that. I would repot them into something a little bit bigger because most of them are quite root bound. And I would, if you've had them outside, I would definitely spray them off with neem oil or insecticidal soap because they've probably got spider mites or any number of other insects on them that you don't want to bring in.
Yeah.
Keep them in good light over the winter. And I don't guarantee that they're going to make it through too well.
No, not necessarily. Marty, you have a quick question from Verona.
I do, thank you. We just planted a cherry tree, a couple blueberry bushes, and we got some raspberry things. And I'm wondering, so it's all new. What do I do to prepare those for the winter?
The fruit tree should be, you should use that hardware cloth that I mentioned, so definitely protect the trunk. The raspberries, you shouldn't have to do anything. The blueberry should be protected for the first winter from freezing temperatures, so you may want to use a rose cone for that.
But wait until after the ground is frozen.
Right.
To do that.
Yep.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's see, somebody else had a call. Oh, Virginia creeper. A friend of mine, Mary says, from Gay's Mill, says that Virginia creeper kills trees. Certainly very visible on dead trees, but does it cause their death?
Not usually. It can, particularly on a young tree, it can kind of smother it. But usually on older trees, it's not a big problem. I would say that it might be an indirect cause, but unless it really strangles the tree by getting tangled around it and then, you know, girdling it, it's usually not too big of an issue.
Lots of great questions, Lisa, and lots of great answers from you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well,
really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. She'll be back, definitely, and we'll talk with her again about what's going on in your garden and mine. We, on Monday, will get an update on our state's bat population and a preview of Bat Fest coming to Milwaukee. Then at 11:45, our weather guys will be here. It's got to be the last Monday of the month because they come by then to talk with us about weather forecasts and answer your weather questions. Stay with us. Lots in store.